Imagine a world where innovation knows no bounds. At BAE Systems Fast Labs, we're pioneering advanced technology and defense research, shaping the future of safety and security. Explore our website to uncover a realm of cutting-edge projects, collaborations, and visionary thinkers. Whether you're a tech enthusiast, a defender of freedom, or just curious, Fast Labs is where groundbreaking solutions are born. Join us and be part of the future today. Visit www.baesystems.com/fastlabs. Welcome to From the Crow's Nest, a podcast on electromagnetic spectrum operations, and this is our AOC member subscriber-only edition. I want to welcome everyone who is in the audience joining us. And, of course, want to welcome my guests here. We have, as usual, Matt Thompson, AOC's senior analyst, and John Knowles, the Journal of Electromagnetic Dominance, the editor-in-chief. I can't get
It's just the acronym.
It's a big JED. It was throwing me off. John Knowles from the JED. Editor-in-chief. Thanks, gentlemen, for joining me here on the show. Before we get started on the discussion, just a quick reminder for those in the audience, this is the AOC member subscriber-only edition. However, until we get the episodes behind a paywall here in the coming weeks, we are making it free to everybody. So if you are listening, if you're in the audience, you're not an AOC member, please consider doing so as soon as possible. These are going to go behind a paywall here probably in the next few weeks. But until then, enjoy it free. And then, of course, if you're unable to join us in the audience when we record, you can, of course, download the episode on when we release it Wednesday. Today is Tuesday, April 16th, and we will release it tomorrow on Wednesday. Also, and then for our audience, we can't see you. But you can see us. So that puts us at a little bit of a disadvantage. So I would encourage you all to, at the bottom of your screen, you'll see a chat button. You can go into that chat button and just say hi. You can introduce yourself. You can give your name if you want. And if you have any comments or questions to share throughout the episode, please do so. We'll try to get to as many comments and questions as we can. We do not give names of our audience over the air. So if you're concerned about, you know, your name being mentioned, please don't worry about that. We will keep everything anonymous, but certainly use that chat function. This is a time for you to engage us as hosts and guests on a range of topics geared mostly toward current events. So with that, I want to welcome Matt and John from the Crow's Nest. Great to have you guys on.
Thanks,
again.
Thanks, Scott. Yeah, cool. Thanks, Ken.
All right. So a lot going on over the last couple of weeks since we had you on recently last month. Obviously, the big thing in the news that I wanted to kind of start off with that, you know, of course, is on every headline is what took place over in Israel over the weekend with the direct drone missile attack from Iran that was quite frankly, like, unsuccessful from a, you know, Israel, along with the U.S. And Jordan, you know, I think some estimates are that we were able to, you know, knock down 99% of what came over. But it certainly was it was an event that kind of woke people up to some of the instability going on over there. Obviously, everyone's watching the war in Israel with Gaza, but this was all of a sudden, now brings in the entire region in a way that it hadn't really in people's minds. So just wanted to kind of kick this off, the discussion. There's a few headlines we want to get to related to this, both in terms of what it means for EW, what it means for regional security, U.S. participation in the efforts, but just to kind of kick things off, get some initial thoughts. I'll turn to you, Matt. What are some of your thoughts as you were reading the headlines this weekend about what's going on?
Yeah, so I think it's a great discussion, right? And I remain an operator, so I don't think it was an epic failure. I think it was. I think that anytime that you do something, regardless of what side of the fence you're on, you can learn things. Like, I don't really believe that Iran had any great, like, that they were going to conquer Israel over the weekend. Like, you know, I don't necessarily feel that that's what they were doing. You know, I think they put up some stuff to see what the response would look like, to see what we would do, to see like where the line in the sand is, how much they can push and get away with. So you know, I think if anyone believes that there was to, you know, their intent was to destroy Israel on the weekend, I think that's, you know, probably not true. You know, but I guarantee they learned some things. You know, they threw up 300 drones and got them destroyed, but I think they were probably okay with that. I think there was quite a bit of calculation in that decision, you know, and, you know, there's already been like a push that there's going to be retaliation. So, you know, in some ways they may have got exactly what they wanted. I guess we're going to see how it plays out in the next few weeks.
John, any thoughts to add to that?
So as a journalist, I'm always aware of what we don't know, which is a lot out there. So, you know, was Iran using its best, you know, was this a sincere attempt by Iran? From what I can tell, no, they were using North Korean supplied missiles for the most part. Those were some of the only ones that have that range. It was interesting the mix they used. So there was a lot of drones in there that were probably designed to absorb or take away some of the kinetic magazine that the US and Israel and Jordan and others threw in there. So that mix is interesting. That's not something when we really started talking about missile defense back in the 90s in earnest as a country. I don't think we thought about, we just thought about ballistic missiles coming over, and we didn't look at the I won't call it the drones decoys, but definitely like multi-vector, multi-types of attack. But to Matt's point, it worked, but everybody's learning something from this. I also think like in the background, that article I sent you earlier from Dr. Thomas P.M. Barnett on his blog, he really talks about how there's, you know, Israel may have started this, or not started it, but knew this was coming after their attack at the Iranian consulate in Syria. Everybody was ready for this. This was not a surprise. This wasn't like October 7th or anything like that. So everybody that was involved in air defense over there in this coalition was waiting for something to happen.
There seemed to be some degree, and I didn't know this until reading the article, you know, at least to the extent that there seemed to be some degree of advance warning that this was going to happen and executed in such a way that it wasn't 300, 350 all at once. It was staged over a period of time. You know, some of those early reports didn't really go into that level of detail. So I found it kind of a little bit interesting that it did provide some degree of ability to respond appropriately. The question that I would have is, you know, well, one of the interesting things I think comes out of this as well, regardless of advance warning, success rate, et cetera, is, you know, at least in the national debate, we always hear about the nuclear capabilities of Iran as they're pursuing those. And we talk a lot about Iran sanctions, but we don't really get a look at Iran's military capabilities and capacity, because so much of what they do is through proxies, Yemen and over in other countries in the Middle East and Lebanon and stuff. So this actually gave us an interesting look at what their capacity is, and in a way that I don't think, at least for the average American, we really had the insight into. Certainly we did at the national military level, but at the general population, we got a look at what their capabilities, what they've been building up over the years, and what they're capable of. And it kind of puts Iran in a different light.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's not that they were never capable of it, but for the larger world, I think everybody focused on their nuclear program, and the other half of that is the delivery mechanism. So focusing on their missile program, this goes for any country. Yes, North Korea and others. Got to look at again, because Iran got so much of its, or has gotten so much of its ballistic missile capability from North Korea. You got a look at least what North Korea has been able to export to countries like Iran.
Yeah, so I think,
but what we,
yeah, I think yeah, it's interesting discussion. Like, Matt, you know, so I have not been focused on the nuclear side of things for a very long time. Like, I'm more concerned with the infinite number of small things that they have, right? The small boat tactics, the swarming in the Gulf, like they've been doing that stuff for decades. And, you know, we don't really have, like, you know, we haven't figured out the best solution yet. And I think that, you know, a great example of that is, you know, the Iron Dome system was pretty well known, pretty famous, like supposed to be pretty capable. I think this was a, all right, let's see what it really does. And, you know, it proved to be very formidable. But it, I think they gathered some data about it and the Aero 2 and Aero 3 and like some systems that really hadn't proven that they could do things. Like, you know, we've talked about it and you see it in the news, but, you know, they've proven that they can do what they're supposed to do. But now there's some data out there of, you know, maybe some gaps in the, you know, places where maybe it can be susceptible to things.
Yeah. So Matt, we shared an article from Admiral Stavridis.
Yeah.
Stavridis, yeah. Yes. And he kind of mentions that, you know, the future efforts, future attacks, when they come, are going to look a lot different based on what they learned here. What are some of the things that, just from your operational perspective, what are some of the things that now Iran knows about how we respond as well as Jordan and Israel respond to such attacks? What are some of the lessons learned that they probably gleaned from this?
Yeah, so I really like, Admiral Stavridis was the strike group commander when I was flying in VAQ-137. So, you know, carrier strike group commander at the time, I got to hear him speak a lot. But one thing that, like, I think that he does really well is he kind of looks at the big picture from all different angles. So I think, you know, if you read that article, he talks about, you know, we're shooting SM-2s, cool, at $2 million a pop, like, you know, we are basically flushing money. And at some point, we're going to run out of those, right? Like, if they keep throwing 300 drones, like, over the wall, like, for several days, we're going to run out of those. And then what are we going to do? So, you know, he kind of talks about, you know, what are John's hot buttons? Like, you know, why don't those ships have lasers? Why isn't there directed energy? Why aren't there other things that are cheaper, better, going against those kind of assets? So I think that, you know, one of the things he talks about is this may be the push that we need to pursue other avenues instead of just keep throwing really expensive missiles at drones all day, which is probably arguably not the best approach.
Yeah, I mean, I know we talked about the, you know, the deployment and operational readiness of lasers, high power microwave weapons, and so forth. In previous episodes, I think this is a perfect example to kind of opportunity to dive into that. You know, John, I want to go turn over to you. We need these deployed soon, faster than maybe we thought just a few weeks ago. I think this shows that you can't be shooting down unmanned drones with missiles very long. And, you know, we were talking about the capacity issue of Iran. I mean, to the extent that such an attack like this was, you know, there's advance warning, everything, you know, staged so that it was relatively it controlled opportunities to escalate outside of the attack. It leads us to believe that this was not anywhere near, this is probably only just a fraction of Iran's capacity. You know, like they clearly have a lot more ready, because it does not seem to be an attack that was geared to, like, let's make them hurt right now. So that means it's coming and we have to be ready. So talk to us a little bit about the importance of getting high power microwave weapons and lasers onto ships and into theater at a faster clip.
I think the thing that sets all this up is that I go back to the, you know, 2012, 13, 14 timeframe, Bob Work and the conversations that they were having at DOD for third offset, and the sort of notional scenario was a salvo competition. And now we're seeing salvo competitions, right? Now we're seeing, like, we never really had that. You know, the closest thing we had to that up until now is World War II, where we had epic math going on in terms of bombers and who can get through and fighters and flak and things like that. And so now we're back to epic math in salvo competitions. But I think Ukraine, to a certain extent, has been a salvo competition between kinetic air defense systems and drones. Were never, you know, we, until recently, obviously, until the last 10 years, drones were never part of that equation of, again, going back to the conversation about we were starting with missile defense in the 90s. We weren't really thinking about drones as something that's going to suck up a lot of your SM-2s, to Matt's point. And now that's there, right? And they're cheap, and they're, you know, they're weapons, but they're also kind of decoys too, to a certain extent, in the sense of what, you know, what you fire at those drones is going to be what, you know, if you don't have a lot of tools in your toolkit, you're going to have a problem. So there's both, I don't want to make directed energy into a panacea because it has a lot of range limitations. It is endless, but its range is not. A missile can go a lot farther than a laser, typically, depending on the atmospheric, somewhere you're firing it from and what level. And if you're in the Red Sea and it's very humid, you're not going to get a lot of range. High power microwave, same thing. You have a range issue. So when you think about those things, high power microwaves and directed energy are great right now at the power levels we have for own ship protection, right? You were even seeing this in the Red Sea. So, if you had directed energy on all the, Royal Navy and U.S. Navy ships in the Red Sea trying to protect it themselves, that's probably going to work. Trying to protect a cargo ship that's being, has a salvo launched at it with a combination of ballistic cruise missiles, USVs, trying to protect that when it's 4 or 5 more kilometers away, is your directed energy system really designed to do support, right? So that's a big question, right? Right now, we don't have that tool in the toolkit, or those tools in the toolkit. And then you get into land defense, right? And area defense. Again, most of these missiles that Iran fired, from my understanding, were fired at military targets. So that protection might have worked, but if they've been fired at cities or civilian populations spread around Israel or something like that, that's where you're probably really pushing the limits of how widely can you deploy these and where are you deploying them and how many can you deploy? I guess when we talk about direct energy, we should talk about its limitations and understand that it is a piece of an air defense system. It's probably not going to be the weapon of the future alone. And so you're going to always need that mix. And that's the question with these salvos, is what's your mix?
And what is your ability to continue to upgrade and expand that range of those weapons in a timely manner? I mean, we are now in 2024. I mean, we've been talking about deploying lasers for really decades. I know Matt is on his way to a directed energy conference, I guess, next month, talking about, from an S&T perspective, it's been a frustrating topic to discuss because it just doesn't feel like it's moving across that valley of death fast enough. So even if we were to get them deployed, obviously we have to keep them upgrading them, expanding the range, improving them. We don't seem to have a good track record at meeting those that pace of development. So, what are some of the things? I mean, put yourself in DOD for a little bit. What are some of the things that we need to be really focusing our energy on? No pun intended. To actually make timely and effective progress in deployment of these in cooperation with a range of other things. We obviously have to continue to restock, all pieces of that integrated air defense, including the other platforms and systems we use and radars and so forth. So what do we need to do differently than maybe we were ready to do before?
Yes, I think the biggest thing, and this is going to be, I don't know, there's probably going to be some people that maybe don't agree with me, but I think we need to change our philosophy a little bit. I'll try to explain what I mean by that. So we kind of had a running joke in the Navy for a long time that, there's a good chance that when you're flying around, the Russians would shoot 4 missiles at you, but 2 of them might not work, but 2 of them might, right? But that's not the American philosophy. I'm shooting 1 missile. I'm going to spend however much money it takes, and it's going to work every single time. Like that's how we do things. But, there's a lot to be said for sending 300 drones with the idea that maybe 300 aren't getting home, but we generally don't take that approach to things. Like, we're shooting 1 time and we're going to kill you that 1 time. Like, we very much take a one shot kill kind of sniper approach but now as we're looking at, Iran's a great example, because I guarantee that 300 drones is a drop in the bucket, right? When you start talking about attrition and the cost of that, like, sure, we have 100 missiles that are all going to work, but they have 1,000. Like, we're going to lose that battle. And I think, direct energy is just a piece of that, right? So maybe the lasers don't work all the time, but we have to have more than just, what I would call a limited arsenal of things that we know are going to work every time, because we're going to run out of those things, at least in my opinion.
And John, you mentioned, you know, going back to that salvo, the salvo topic, you know, with Bob Work, former Deputy Secretary of Defense Bob Work, and his discussion of the third offset and that salvo versus salvo kind of construct that led to the third offset. That's also changed. The conversation of, you know, it used to be salvos of missiles coming out, and then, you know, some unmanned systems, and then obviously the number of unmanned systems increased in those scenarios as we were going through Ukraine. But now, like with that number that we – just that quantity that we see, it's probably changing our perspective on what – when we talk about salvo, I mean, this was a very measured controlled attack. A real salvo that's meant to actually do damage could be thousands.
Yeah.
And yeah, all at once.
So, like, how did yeah.
And so how do you, as a U.S., you know, how do you keep up with that? What tools are in our toolbox? You know, we can change the philosophy of how we buy and deploy, but when we're talking, you know, .milPF across the range of everything we do in DoD, we've seen changes very slow. If it even happens at all. So, what are some of the things that we need? What role do you see EW playing? Bring it back to MSO. How can EW make this successful response?
So I think, just for quickly going back to the direct energy question, I think one thing we forget about direct energy is the systems that we're putting out there right now are the systems that we're fielding right now are largely, they're smaller, relatively speaking, shorter range. And so they work with existing power plants under the hood, if it's a vehicle or the ship's power plant. When you get into higher power, longer range that you really want at the end of the day to be able to not just protect your own platform, but provide support, you're talking about redesigning the ship, and the ship's power plant has to work. You know, if it's an HPM system, do you have to harden everything on your ship? Because you're firing an HPM weapon off your ship, right? And you're not sure where the antenna pattern, if it slews the wrong way or something, even if you have a directional antenna, you know, you're not positive where the energy is leaking from. And so it's not just EMI, it's worse.
I think that's a gap that we're talking about. Like, why does that ship have to be powered? Why does it have to be manned? You know what I mean? Like, why can't it be a drone with its own power plant? Like, I mean, I just think that we're still like limiting the way and scope of how we're looking at things. You know, we know that part of the Red Sea is contested, has been for a long time. Like, you know, why don't we have some permanent like unmanned ships that have a big power plant? And I mean, there's ways to kind of start to solve that problem, but we're unwilling to kind of have those discussions.
Yeah, or airborne, right? If we can get it down to the size of a airborne platform, that gets you you don't have to worry about, you can shoot, if the laser, shoot down instead of shooting across the surface of the ocean where there's higher humidity, more atmospherics that you're dealing with, or the drones get closer to the target. So, and theoretically they, you know, don't need the power. So you're right. Like that paradigm of our large complex weapon systems being the homes of all the direct energy, systems is again, it's that mix that you want. So sorry, Ken, I wasn't answering your question. EW role, again, EW's is a very flexible tool. It doesn't solve every problem, but it does a lot. It can get places, doesn't need the power to get the job done. EW, everything is an aperture even if it's not intended to be an aperture, any unshielded circuit or wire, exposed wire, anything you can couple into, you can get energy in there, right? And so that's a really helpful thing. And that's why, again, EW is also a tool. So I think part of it, and I go back to this idea of the Air Force has this conversation, you know, when they talk bombers, they get like bomber mix, right? Like we want B1s and B2s and B52s and B21, and they'll figure out their force mix. when they have a fire discussion, it's like Highlander. There can only be one, right? And so I think when we think about this problem, we have to get away from there can only be one, or a best one is the one we're going to invest in, as opposed to, you know, my toolbox down in my basement has like 5 different hammers, 25 different screwdrivers. You know, I need that tool. None of them are exotic, you know, high-end things, but every one of those things gets a job done that I need to get done somewhere around my house.
Hello, everyone. I want to take a short break to thank BAE Systems Fast Labs for the continued support for our From the Crow's Nest podcast. I am pleased to be here today with Bill Watson, Chief Scientist at BAE Systems Fast Labs. Bill, it's great to be here with you. Now, BAE Systems Fast Labs is BAE Systems Research and Development and Production Organization. Can you tell us a little bit about Fast Labs as well as your background?
Yes, and thank you for having me. BAE Systems Fast Labs is dedicated to innovating disruptive next-generation solutions for the critical defense and intelligence challenges. Of course, electronic warfare is one of our key focus areas, but in addition to that, we also do research in autonomy and AI, sensing and response, advanced microelectronics, communications, and navigation. I've been working in the RF, that is radio frequency research community, for over 20 years, a short time in the United States Air Force, followed by specific research and development. My work in the last 20 years has been singularly focused on DARPA research, and within the last 10 years at BAE Systems Fast Labs specifically. Technology we work on spans sensor processing to high-level sense-making, up to tactical and operational-level autonomy and decision-making support. And one of the key differentiators about BAE Fast Labs is the research that we do is intended to find its way to benefit the warfighter.
This has been an important topic through many of our recent episodes here on From the Crow's Nest. Can you talk a little bit more about that technology? And for our audience, how does it change or affect our EW capabilities that we're trying to field?
In our work with leading DoD customers like DARPA or AFRL, we focus on developing technologies that will advance future solutions, from overcoming today's challenges to developing technologies never before thought to be possible. We then transition our technology to fieldable products to benefit our warfighters through partnership with BAE Systems Electronic Systems product lines. As a specific example, I thought I'd use a movie you may or may not be familiar with. It was called Battle Los Angeles. It was from 2011. And in that movie, aliens it had invaded. And what the characters in the movie found is that whenever they keyed their microphones on their radios, they could be easily geolocated and targeted. What the movie presented as science fiction for us is, in fact, science fact. This is the type of technology that we work on and exist today, where the physics meets the real world.
This sounds like absolutely fascinating work. What is the next area that you see for research and development? And if anyone is interested in learning more, how can they reach out to you?
Well, we can't say too much because of the sensitivity of our work at classification levels. But in Fast Labs, we are always working on the future state. No matter what the future threats are, we will continue to focus on solving the hardest problems to benefit the warfighter. If you're interested in more information about Fast Labs, you can connect with us on our website at baesystems.com/fastlabs.
Well, thank you, Bill, for joining me here on From the Crow's Nest. And now it's time to get back to our show. So I want to pull that thread a little bit in terms of what specific tools are we talking about out there that need to kind of grab our attention a little bit more. We do have a comment from the audience, and I want to get your response. Talking about, we need to start thinking about who handles battle space management aspect of merging all these theater weapon systems. That is a very important piece because, once everything starts, what is the saying? Every no good plan survives first contact with the enemy. Like once the shootings does start, you need to be
adaptable and flexible.
Have a management plan in place and ready to go. So talk a little bit about battle space management, and of course, spectrum management and piece in responding to such an attack in the future.
Yeah. So I talked to.
I'll start with you, Matt.
About this a little bit on the last podcast, right? Like this is so once we get like what are all the tools look like figured out, I think this is the bigger problem, right? Because this is where I still see the services kind of bickering a little bit. Well, I want to be in charge of this piece. Like, I own that sky, or I own this piece of ground. I think the combined battle space is going to be the area where there's going to be less collaborative. Like, I think everyone agrees that we need all these tools. I think there's still, you know, pretty significant disagreement about who runs all the tools or who has the toolbox. Like, I think, you know, and I think that discussion is going to continue when you talk about Fifth Fleet and SETCOM. And like, it's we've already broken the world up into these different, like, we've already drawn lines in the sand already and said, well, this person's kind of responsible for that. But, you know, I've seen many times where, you know, there's overlapping areas where there's disagreements even now when we're not talking about all these tools. So I think that problem is going to be a significantly more difficult political nut to try to crack, because I think there's still going to be pushback of who's going to try to own what.
Yeah, I think that, and this goes back to some conversations I've had with Brian Hinckley, the AOC president. But, you know, we talk about in our conversations sometimes, you know, who has the MSO piece on the operational side, right? So on the air side, you could use the Navy as an example, right? On the air side, we've got, you know, we've got Whidbey Island, we've got a Commodore there, and there's somebody who's thinking operationally about AEA for the Navy and really jointly, right? But you get to the surface ship side, and they're the operational. Who is that? Is it the surface warfare officer? Is it because right now the highest ranking EW person on those ships is a chief. It's not somebody that's got wide operational command. And so getting back to what Matt's talking about, you know, do you have a MSO commander, a senior MSO commander handling all these issues? It can't just be a GEMSO cell. That's just advising somebody higher up. But if that operational commander isn't super schooled in MSO, because most of them aren't, because that would have been a career killer probably for them, then being cynical there, but yeah, there, it's not a deep thing in the operational world with MSO. So that's going to be you got to school up a lot of people and get experienced EWs out there, and not just in an advisory role, but a decision-making role. And I think that's a big piece.
I'll give you a great story, a little tongue-in-cheek at the time, but, you know, we kind of had moved into Fifth Fleet and the CENTCOM, and, you know, we've sent a guy to the CAOC, and they're like, who are you? What do you do? Okay, there's a desk over there in the corner, like, right? You know, because they're working on a full cycle. They're busy already. Like, there's not a window or an amount of time to incorporate all those new pieces. And we were just one piece. Like, now we're talking about lots of different tools showing up. Oh, hey, you know, John, thanks for showing up. Like, what do you do? There's a desk in the corner, right? Like it takes a time to get built into that cycle. And the battle space management that currently exists, like, there's not windows. Like, they're already planning for tomorrow's, like, airplane. You know what I mean? Well, you're not on it. Like, well, when can I get on it? Well, I don't know what you do yet. So, you know, there's going to be 3 or 4 days before you even get rolled into the first one. Like, I think that part is really difficult. And it requires, you know, John's like, well, they have to be really educated. There's not going to be time to get educated. Like, you're going to have to accept a little bit that, well, I don't know what John does, but I need to get him on there, and we need to figure out what he does by actually putting him in the fight. So I think that discussion will be interesting too.
So and the conversation, the topic about training, getting the human capital that we need into the right spots, in the right quantities, is that was a topic, Matt, of one of the topics of your workshop down in San Antonio last month. I want to get to that in a minute. But I wanted to go back to talking about the specific tools. And John, I'll bring you in on this, with the defense budget. You know, what are some of the tools that need our attention as the MSO community moving forward, either specific programs or capabilities out there that need to get greater attention? Because when you're looking at the budget, I think one of the concerns we've talked about, you know, you see procurement and R&D both sliding back. The defense budgets are increasing, but a lot of that's going to personnel and readiness, which may, you know, that can go to both training as well as quality of life and so forth. But there's a lot of pressure on procurement and R&D. You have systems getting more expensive, Matt and I were talking about an article on the F-35. The life cycle cost of the F-35 is what, $1.2 trillion now?
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's insane. We can't continue to develop programs like this. Too much pressure on the budget. And that's going to impact, that's going to have downstream effects on a lot of different programs. So as a community, we need to be very clear. Here's what we need based on our operational experience. Here's what we should be investing in. What are some of your thoughts about where we need to be directing that that attention?
So instead of, let me give you like a global answer first, which is the big muscle movements are software and open architectures, because hardware is just not, you're not going to field new systems fast enough, right? This goes back to our last conversation the three of us had about whether the COCOMs need to have more acquisition authority or more people or whatever in the MSO field specifically, because the services are great at delivering large complex weapon systems, are not great at it, but that's what they think about more, ships, aircraft, things like that. But it's the software. And again, I'm going to give you my home example, which is I will keep upgrading the software on my computers until I have to buy a new computer. But my software cycle is way faster, and those things, the capability that I get on my computers comes through software. And then every few years, I'll buy a new computer if I need to, once the software starts pushing it too hard. But that mentality is based on getting rapid access to software and the upgrades within those software, you know, programs that I get. But also it's the open architecture concept that we all have on our home computers. It's still, the DoD is still sort of learning how to deal with that on their end. So, the Air Force to me has at least a building block in place, which is a 350th. I keep coming back to that. But where's the Army and the Navy on that? Like, why aren't they doing something like that? Because that is speed to field when you can do it in software, right? And that to me is something you want to replicate across the services if they want to remain relevant to the operational, to the warfighters. So that's my big picture thing. And that's bigger than just EW. That's obviously all your electronics. But beyond that, like specific programs. So again, I'm going to come back to the mentality. Matt's point earlier, the mentality has to change. We have to think more in terms of quantity, low end, quantity over quality, because you know the decoys are amazing tools, right? They really not just saturate an air defense system and force them to fire more missiles than they want to and things like that, but it literally preoccupies the thinking and it really slows them down. They're trying to sort out a picture that's getting more and more complicated. And decoys should be cheap, right? Decoys should be expendable, cheap. You know, you want them to have legs to the extent that they can get in there as far as you want. But that type of tool set, I don't think we've invested or thought about that enough. It's just, you know, a time thing. Opening up an air quarter for a B-21, it doesn't require a bunch of manned aircraft to come in and do something crazy. It requires a lot of decoys to really confuse the air picture, especially if there's passive radars out there. Those are really vulnerable to decoys because they're looking for that. Yeah. You know?
I think that's something that we don't talk about enough, right? Like we act like the enemy doesn't have AR and machine learning too. Like, right. Like they're not, their picture's not getting built as fast as ours. Like it is. I mean, we have to be realistic that, you know, when I put up a flight of F-15s and that's it. Like, those guys aren't coming home. You know, like, we have to do more to really make things hard for them. But I want to kind of completely shift gears when we kind of answer the question. So it was something when I was reviewing the SAW, like, workshop, the EW workshop we had here. And there were two things that we really kind of talked about. One, we kind of have a tendency, good, bad, or otherwise, to over-classify programs. But the problem with that is that it makes it very, very hard to get people with appropriate clearances in a right, reasonable amount of time and in the right numbers, right? So one, we have to maybe look at streamlining or making the clearance process easier, or not overclassifying programs where we can't get people into them. So, you know, it makes the STEM challenge very difficult to try to get the right people in the right amount So I definitely think that's one of the focuses that we kind of talked about. Like, one, how do I get more people? Because I'm going to struggle with that anyway. And two, by the way, that takes them 24 months to get a clearance. They're not going to hang out that long. They're going to go, you know, work somewhere else like Google, because they're not going to, like, it's a hassle. Like, we kind of have to be more cognizant of that as we build these super programs that, you know, we classify with very high levels that maybe don't have to be. So.
Yeah, so you mentioned the San Antonio workshop. That was a key point, and I think a lot of this does come down to the human capital side, the education that we provide, the billets that we provide open up. And another topic, and I'm going to use this as a segue, that we discussed at the San Antonio workshop, and it's a topic that at AOC we're going to be focusing on a lot more here coming into the summer months, and that's the notion of spectrum management and how we allocate spectrum, how we manage the access to that spectrum, how we partner or work with the private telecommunications companies. Matt, I'll come to you first to talk a little bit about how that was discussed, what you learned on that piece from the San Antonio topic. And then probably for the next 20 minutes, I'll let John talk about this, because this is I think we talked about this like 2 hours yesterday. But I think it's an important conversation, because it really does show where some of the disconnects we are having on a larger scale between DOD, our services, private, public sector, and some of the fissures that we have to figure out how to overcome here if we're going to make progress. So, Matt, I'll start with you with the San Antonio workshop. What did you learn?
Yeah, so first I'm going to make sure and lay the groundwork so I can really fire John up, because I try to be objective, right? We live in a capitalist country that relies on, you know, companies making money. Especially telecom is a very big company. Like, I get that. There's lots of organizations that are fighting for space. So I get the argument, right? I understand what they're trying to do and why the requests that they're making. And by the way, I don't know, we've talked about it before, but the spectrum is only so big. Like, that we're going to run out of it. Like, it's the facts of physics. Like, we can't break them, at least not yet anyway. So that reality, like, I fully get that. The operator side of me says, I don't want to give up any spectrum ever. Like, it's not ideal for me. But you know, I try to be objective and understand both arguments. I think that we need to continue to do a good job of finding out what the right balance of that is, right? We can't just give up huge chunks because the telecom would like that. We have to be able to defend our position on why we need to keep it too. But we also have to be a little open-minded and say, you know, we can't close it off. Like, you know, the telecom can't have any of it. Like, that's an unrealistic position. And if that's the position that we go in with, I think we're going to lose that battle. So, you know, I think that we have to really sit down and say, okay, what do we really need? You know, how do we negotiate that? What does that look like? And I don't know that we are doing a good enough job like doing that. So, you know, I think that we have to be more honest and realize that we're going to probably have to give up some spectrum. Like, it's going to happen. And if we don't make a decision on what that looks like, we're going to give it all up, and then we're going to wish we had. With that, I will let John just go off the handle.
Yeah. Well, before I go to John, I mean, this was the thrust of our conversation yesterday. I mean, we've been talking, you know, I think as far back really as the early 2000s, when we sold off a portion of spectrum where the B2 radar function, we've realized, oh, we weren't quite ready for that. And then there was Legato, I think it was Legato at the time. I think it's Light Squared or something now. That issue came up in the around 2010, 2012 timeframe. And that was kind of a moment where we're like, we have to change how we think as DOD toward spectrum allocation management. I ran some congressional briefings all the way back then in my first stint with AOC on dynamic spectrum sharing and how that's going to change. We are here in 2024, and it's hard for me to really sense how much progress we've made. Because I feel like we're still stuck in that kind of that same mentality.
So I have a great like real world example real quick of what I think what I think is going to happen to us if we don't do better. So I know, you know, Ken, you're a pretty big like pro sports fan. Are you a college sports fan at all? So the NCAA, like, kept putting their head in the sand. They're like, well, you know what? They're never going to give players money. Like, it's never going to be a deal. And everyone's like, it's coming. They're like, nope, it's never going to happen. It's coming. Nope. But now NIL, like, the law changed overnight. And, like, the NCAA is scrambling ever since. And it's been a train wreck. They're losing on every avenue because they did zero preparation. Like, they just said, yep, it's never going to happen. And my worry is that the DOD is just doing the same thing, right? Hey, it's never going to happen. They're never going to take space away from us. That they are. Like, we need to figure out what that's going to look like, and we have to be honest about it and really fight for the pieces we want, or it's all going to be gone, and we'll be like, what just happened?
And I think, you know, based on no matter what metric you use, we're always going to lose out to commercial private sector, you know, because both because people don't quite understand it, as well, you know, how the military uses that spectrum, but also just in terms of sheer, you know, the population and how each one of our lives depends on it on a daily basis. So we're always going to lose the debate, no matter what metric you use. It seems obvious, but there we're hiding behind that national security waiver, kind of that clause, and that's comforted us for that's protected us for a while. But now it's, you know, is dynamic spectrum sharing the answer? Is that something that has to be the one of the top focuses focuses of DOD moving forward? John, I'll let you comment on this get a sense of where
that's
we need
good
to go.
Winding me up. That's good.
Let's go.
And go.
So I obviously feel like we're on the Titanic and that iceberg looks like it's 5 miles away and it's right under our ship. So it's just a part we don't see. So there's a couple aspects here. Going back to LightSquared, that should have set the DOD on fire. That should have been like, wow, these guys did exactly what they were supposed to do. They stayed out of their, you know, they narrowed down the frequencies and they stay inside what they said they were going to do, right? But the DOD systems weren't good enough for that. And so we needed bigger guard bands or whatever was going on. And LightSquared was like, we're going to go over and above what we're supposed to do. We're trying to accommodate that. Round two happened. And then I think the thing that really bugged me about LightSquared was the DOD played its national security card, right, without ever trying to compromise or figure this out. And so the part that really bugged me wasn't even the technical part. It was that they didn't even do a technical study on this before everyone took their positions in DOD and especially in Congress. So even when their technical report came out and said, this should not be an issue, this is probably going to be fine, this is like 2020, somewhere in there, you had like half the members of the Armed Services Committee, Senate and House, just hammered LightSquared with all these threats, right? So here we are, we have elected officials threatening a company doing what it said it would do, staying inside its bounds and still getting threatened. And if you're a shareholder in that company, you know, that's not the message you want to get, right? So that whole situation had just so many bad things going around it for the most part. But it should have alerted the DOD that the old system, and I call it the farm system, right? That fixed frequency allocation where you get this frequency, whether you use it or not, and the DOD famously uses their stuff. Their frequency is like 10% of the time, right? But they own 60% of the usable spectrum, right? But they have this. And then here's the commercial side, and they use the hotel system. You know, you get a room in a hotel in a certain place in a certain time for one night or for as long as you need it, and then you're out of there. And so the commercial side has been able to get a lot more users into their spectrum with that much more dynamic system. And the DOD, I understand why the DOD doesn't want to go do that on its own everywhere, but it's going to have to tilt something where it's able to go into certain spectrum that maybe it rents that or has access to that what commercial space uses it, and they just act like a commercial user. They go in and use it when they want or need it, and maybe they have priority, you know, something like that. Again, you know, some aspect of it. But I think about that, and I think the DOD just keeps it's so slow. It hasn't really had this, it's a culture problem, right? So you don't change your culture so you have like a near-death experience for most companies or most entities. And I think that the DoD just is still like kind of sleepwalking into the future on Spectrum. And again, they're the Titanic getting closer to that iceberg, not realizing what's right under the surface that it's that reaches out that far. And so they're it's frustrating because one thing I don't understand about it, I don't know enough about all the potential technical solutions to make this work for the DoD. But the other thing is I look at all these other countries that don't have this problem. I don't know if some of that is because most other countries don't have a global power projection strategy. They don't have to go project power around the world. But we have a problem here, partly because of maybe some old thinking with old institutional policy and things like that, that have stayed with us, even on the FCC side, maybe too. I still think a lot of our spectrum policy dates back to like 1933 or whatever, whenever the FCC was created, and NTIA and things like that are obviously, working it. But you have this dynamic commercial market and the DoD is learning zilch from that. And they're not even responding to the reality of the pressure that's coming there. Because I think Matt's right. I think that commerce is going to win if you just keep sticking your head in the ground and pretend that problem's not there. We'll keep, every time they ask for more spectrum, and even just thinking about it as losing spectrum as opposed to sharing spectrum, things like that. Where can the DoD start sharing spectrum without a lot of pain? The problem is the really valuable spectrum, because not all spectrum is equal, like the C-band. That's really valuable for both the commercial side and the defense side. They've got to find, if they had taken to heart the lessons of Lightspeed and Legato starting more than 10 years ago, that we shouldn't be where we are now. But we're still, again, educating a new generation of policymakers and CIO and others that just don't have a plan.
And I think any plan is going to be extremely costly. Whether you have to make technical changes to the equipment that uses that portion of spectrum, or even just institutional change and changing organizations and so forth, it's going to be costly, and it's going to be something that we can't just fund next year when we need it or something. It's got to be baked into the budget, long-term defense planning, because if we're not, then we're not going to be able to keep up with that change when we need it. Gentlemen, it's nearing the end of our time. I actually am moving from this into another recording for our next episode that's going to air next week. So I have to actually end this conversation, and I'm sure we'll continue a lot of the themes when we meet again. I don't know what our schedule is. It might hopefully in a couple weeks. It might be in next month. But I want to thank you, gentlemen, for taking time out of your schedule for joining us here on From the Crow's Nest, live for our AOC member subscriber only edition. And I hope you all have a good weekend. I look forward to continuing talking
with
you. Thanks,
Ken. Fun to talk to you. Thanks.
Well, that will conclude this episode of From the Crow's Nest. I want to thank my guests, Matt Thompson and John Knowles, for joining me. I also want to thank our audience for joining us and participating in the conversation. As always, don't forget to follow, review, and share our podcast. We always enjoy hearing from our listeners, and we appreciate you letting us know how we're doing. That's it for today. Thanks for joining me. Fast Labs, powered by BAE Systems, is at the forefront of advanced technology and defense research, development, and production. They're pushing boundaries, breaking barriers, and innovating for a safer world. Check them out at www.baesystems.com/fastlabs.